Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In this show, I am joined by the wine masters from the 25th Annual Montana State University Billings Foundation Wine and Food Festival. Steve Lord of J. Lord Vineyard and K.R. Rombauer of Rombauer Vineyards join me in the studio to talk about how they came into the wine business, their winemaking philosophy, and then some thoughts on environmental challenges, such as the drought in the last years. Then, in the second part of the show, we learn of what they drink when they are off the clock, and then some tips on how to enjoy drinking wine. Today, I have Steve Lord of J. Lord Vineyards and Wines and K.R. Rombauer of Rombauer Vineyards. J. Lord is located south of San Francisco in the Monterey Paso Robles area, whereas Rombauer reigns in the Napa Valley. Both are the wine masters for the 2017 MSUB Wine and Food Festival. Thank you for being here in Billings.
Hey, Stella, great to be here.
So let's begin with your sharing a brief history of your family and the winemaking world. Steve, why don't you begin?
Okay, Stella. Yeah, so it actually begins with my father, Jerry Lohr. He grew up on a farm in eastern South Dakota, went to school and get a degree in civil engineering at South Dakota State, but had a bad case of hay fever growing up. So he decided to come on out to California and continue his education there. He opened up a custom home building business in the Saratoga area, which is in the southern part of the Bay Area. His building partner was French-Canadian, Bernie Turgeon. So Dad, having grown up on a farm, you know, was used to growing things. Bernie, being French-Canadian, was used to drinking things. So it was a great partnership. And as the environmental movement started to take hold in California in the late 60s, not that that's a problem at all, because we think of ourselves as environmentalists, they wanted to diversify. So in 1972, we planted our very first vineyards in Monterey County.
What a great spot to plant grapes.
Yeah.
And your background?
Yeah, so my background is, growing up in Saratoga, I helped Dad plant our first vineyards when I was 10 years old. And basically every other weekend through junior high and high school, we'd go down and I'd hop on a tractor and go down the rows and get a real feel for, you know, what it takes to grow good grapes. We made our first vintage in 1974 with Petite Syrah, believe it or not, from Monterey County, and Pinot Blanc, which was a much bigger variety at the time than it is now.
And a little bit of a harder sell.
Oh, much. That's right. And then I went on to Stanford and got my degrees in civil engineering and economics. Really liked the entrepreneurial side of engineering. So for many years, I had a custom home building business on the one hand, and also helped Jerry and the rest of our family on wine growing on the other hand.
What a great combination of talents there.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
Well, K.R., tell us about your family history.
Indeed.
Well, and I do want you to start with your name. What does the K.R. stand
for? K.R. stands for Kerner Rumbauer. Now, my father's Kerner Rumbauer Jr., and I'm Kerner Rumbauer III, no middle name. The first name comes from my great-great-grandfather, Gustav Kerner, who had come over from Europe in the mid-1800s and was a lawyer and had worked, was very involved in Abraham Lincoln's administration, became ambassador to Spain. The K.R. stands for Colonel Rumbauer, and working together in the family business, I should say having the privilege to work together in the family business, it just became easier to go by KR. So
okay.
My mom and dad started the winery, and I had to laugh because Steve said I got to help my father plant the vineyard, and I was thinking to myself, at 10 years of age, that's called child labor.
No, it's like child enhancement, right? And then you have been in the Napa Valley ever since.
My mother and father were born and raised in Escondido, California, about 45 minutes east of San Diego. My dad loved mechanical things, joined the Air Force, flew in Ontario, California in the Air Guard for about 8 to 10 years, got hired on with Braniff International around 65, and we moved to Dallas, Texas area, then had a stint out in Walnut Creek, California, in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area, and then back to Texas for a year or two, and then out to the Napa Valley in 1972. So I was born in 63, so Napa Valley feels like home for me. I was about 10 when we moved out there, and it's been a wonderful adventure. My mother and father wanted to raise my sister and I in a rural agricultural environment, and they couldn't have picked a better industry and a more beautiful area to take us and raise us. And I'd have to say Paso Robles, the whole Central Coast area is gorgeous, very unique environment, growing conditions, as we see in Sonoma County, Napa County, up in the Sierra foothills in El Dorado, Amador County. So it's a lot of fun.
And your background is in business.
I, too, had child enhancement labor and didn't know that it was really forced labor at the time, but it seemed like a lot of fun, and you just do it and help your parents and shadow. So I grew up building Con Creek Winery. We were partners at Con Creek Winery from 76 to 80, and it's pretty natural when you're in the Napa Valley to learn and become in contact with grape growers and vintners and winemakers, and that's what my father did. And then we sold our partnership at Con Creek Winery in 1980 and started Rumbauer Vineyards in 1980.
I just think, you know, I'd look back in the 1960s that your parents had such foresight to buy land in some of the most primo places in California. I mean, I feel really sorry for the two of you.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, it was expensive then. I mean, yeah. I could remember my mother and father looking around for a house, and at the time, they couldn't afford it, and you know, now at the time, you can't afford it either. So it's all relative.
Yes, yes.
Whether it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago.
Now, please tell me the philosophy behind the wine your company produces. So I'm going to start with KR.
You know, we're trying to make approachable wines of super high quality, world-class wines that our customers can find, that are out there and available to our customers, and that are affordable. We can all go out and buy beautiful wines that might be $100 or $200 or $300 a bottle, but what about those great wines that, at least in our county, that play at $30, $40, $50 a bottle? And I say that because of land cost and production cost. So in the Central Coast area, because land costs are less, you can play at different price ranges. So, you know, ultimately, we want beautiful, consistent, world-class wines that can be set on the table anywhere and people can really enjoy it.
Steve, what about you?
Yeah, so we are very much looking at making wines that are true to their style, true to their varietal. You know, in other words, if we're making Pinot Noir, we don't want it to taste like Syrah. We want it to taste like Pinot. And also wines that really represent their appellation well. And for us, we have four appellations. Within Monterey, we have vineyards in the Arroyo Seco and the Santa Lucia Highlands. Of course, Paso Robles, and then St. Helena in the Napa Valley. So just trying to make the very best expression of those grapes from those given appellations.
Rombauer makes wines from five varietals: Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Zinfandel, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, whereas J. Lord has over half a dozen categories and labels of wines, including a non-alcoholic option. KR, why only five varietals?
Well, being in the Napa Valley, you know, Steve spoke about appellations, and what came to mind for me is purity of product and artistry and craftsmanship, and I think we both speak the same language. Napa Valley is very well suited for Cabernet Sauvignon from a grape growing standpoint. There's 16 AVAs, American Viticultural Areas, throughout the Napa Valley that have been developed over the last 30 plus years, and so we're very well suited to the varietals that we produce. So the Chardonnay in the southern part of the Canaro, Napa Valley in the Carneros region produces fruit that allows us to make a style of Chardonnay that we very much enjoy, but more importantly, our customers love. We realize that we're in a business that's there's I want things and there's I need things. So people don't need wine. They hopefully want wine.
They need wine.
Hopefully, Rumbauer Vineyards and J. Laura can make styles of wines that people need. So we focus on the varietals we do because we think they're very relevant in the marketplace, and we can also grow that fruit at a very high level in the counties that we're in.
Steve, what is your production, and why have you chosen to provide such a large choice variety for the wine drinker?
Okay. Well, let's see. Our overall production is now 1.6 million cases a year. We've been very, very fortunate in that respect. And it's just been a natural growth as far as what we do grow. Started out in Monterey with some varieties we knew would do well, like Chardonnay and Riesling. And then we took a chance on some varieties, which some professors at the time said, hey, you know, go ahead and give Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot a try, even Petit Sirah. And it might be a little cool, but you should get some good color and flavor out of that. Of course, this is the early 70s, and you know, at the time, it was very common throughout California to plant Chardonnay and Cabernet side by side. We did just that and planted 11 different varieties of grapes and realized, oh my gosh, within about 5 years, we'd made a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. The Cabernet just had all kinds of bell pepper and asparagus flavors, not because those were vegetables growing around it. It's just because it was too cool to properly ripen those big reds. So that's when we came to Napa in 84 and then started planting in Paso Robles in 86. So partly because we're in four different appellations, we concentrate on growing the grapes where they do best. So that has led to 35 different wines that we make at different tiers. For instance, we have a Cabernet called J.Lore Seven Oaks Cabernet. It's our single biggest SKU or single biggest wine that we make. That alone is about 800,000 cases a year. That's about $18 plus or minus. And then we have our Hilltop Cabernet at $35, a Cabernet blend, part of our Cuvée series at $50, and then a Signature Cabernet at $100 a bottle. So we try and have wines that are, I think KR said it very well, approachable. And really, I think both of us try and make wines that are the best values at whatever price level the consumer is seeking. Plus, what we call Ariel, which is our de-alcoholized wine, and kind of a little interesting story on that. Back in 1984, we had a business relationship with Hyatt Hotels nationwide. Wow. At the time, you might remember MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, mm-hmm. was very strong, and they're a great organization. But there was a real question as to, hey, if somebody were to leave a restaurant or a bar and, God forbid, get in an accident and hurt somebody, mm-hmm. where would that liability end? It wasn't sure back then whether that would go back to the restaurant or bar. So the Hyatt Hotel said, hey, can you do something that's non-alcoholic and tasty still? And that's where we kind of worked with a company called Millipore, which is one of the world's leading filter companies, and created filters which are so fine, they actually separate the wine by its molecular weight.
That's amazing.
The smallest molecules in wine are the water and the alcohol molecules, so they go right through the filter, and all the long chain molecules, which give you your aromas and your flavors, they stay behind. So it's kind of like a wine concentrate that we then reintroduce the water that we just took out. And that's Ariel. It's considered the world's highest quality de-alcoholized wine.
Science at work. That is just amazing. All right. With our natural resources becoming more limited, such as water, and at the same time, better technology advancing, share with the listeners some of the pioneering technology you're using at your winery. Let's begin with Steve.
Okay. Well, so you're right. Water is huge for us here in California. We've just come out of 5 years of drought, and our vineyards in St. Helena are actually doing a little better than those on the Central Coast. In the Napa Valley, we got, you know, basically 150, 180 plus percent of normal rainfall this last winter. On the Central Coast in Monterey, Paso, we got pretty much average rainfall. So one of the things that we do is use pressure bombs to determine when to irrigate. Many people will use soil moisture sensors, which are great. That'll tell you how much water is actually in the soil. But what you really need to do is know how much water is required by the vine. So these pressure bombs are pretty simple in their overall design. You put your blade, which is your leaf, into a cylinder, and then you pressurize that, and you have the pedestal or the stem, which just sticks out of that cylinder. And if it doesn't take much pressure to get just the beginning of a little drop at the end of that stem, then you know, okay, that vine has all the water it needs.
KR, what about you?
You know, I think we're all looking at sustainable options for agriculture, and not just in grape growing, but across the board. I think it was in Popular Science magazine a month or two ago, they had a water faucet and sand was coming out of it, and it really hit home. This is an incredible, precious natural resource, and if we're not careful it's going to be a bigger and bigger issue, not just in Northern California or throughout California, all over the world. So I think we're all paying attention and trying to be the best neighbor we can for use of natural resources. There's a lot of technology and there's a lot of old farmer craftsmanship available to us that allows us to be very aware of how to use water. You know, the drip system irrigation that we all use in our vineyards is very specific and precise. Also in the wineries, it used to take upwards of 6 or 7 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of wine. And we're getting that down now to the ultimate goal is to get it down to 1 gallon of water to make 1 gallon of wine. Many of us are down to 2 to 3 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of wine. So it's about caring and being mm-hmm. aware. As Steve had indicated, there's that technology out there that allows us to be very, very careful and very specific to get the best raw product, the best fruit from those grapevines. We want to stress them out a little bit, but not too
much. But not too much.
And that'll increase, ultimately, that'll give us better fruit year in and year out. And it'll also allow us to have a commercial vineyard that should last somewhere between 22 and 25 years, possibly.
And longer, hopefully.
Or longer in some cases.
Welcome back. Let's learn more about Steve Lord and K.R. Rombauer. Finally, this is a quick response exercise. I will say a couple words that may stimulate a memory or reply. So just share what comes immediately to your mind. So I'm going to start with K.R., mentor in the wine world.
Justin Meyer at Silver Oak Winery. He was just a wonderful person, an incredible grape grower, viticulturalist, and an incredible winemaker, enologist or winemaker, and just did it in a really wonderful, matter-of-fact way.
Steve?
Yeah, well, I'm going to maybe be a little biased here, but I'd say it's my father, Jerry Lohr. Dad has just done a huge amount for the industry as, chairman of Wine Institute back in the early 90s. And then also he's done a lot for research for the industry. We spend incredible amount in research each year, second only to Gallo in the country. We don't just keep that to ourselves. We share it with the overall industry, and he's really helped UC Davis and Cal Poly with their wineries and such. So for all of his leadership, I'd say it's Dad.
All right, Steve, I'm going to start with you. Person who taught you to love food.
Ooh, that is a good question. That'd be my mom, actually. This is getting a little familial here, but, mom didn't cook really fancy, but she cooked really cleanly, just good solid ingredients and organic when possible. And you equate food with family and friends so much of the time. And yeah, I'd say it's mom.
All right. KR?
In our family background, my great aunt Irma wrote The Joy of Cooking, Irma Rumbauer. So I was very inspired with that. Unfortunately, I never had a chance to meet her, but her daughter had worked with her on The Joy of Cooking, Miriam Rumbauer. She married a man named Becker and had 2 sons. So her son, Ethan Becker, is intimately involved as 3rd generation. And now his son, John, and his wife are 4th generation. They'll take it through 100 years of publication. So I was very inspired by The Joy of Cooking. But, my wife, Laura Rumbauer, is an incredible cook and could be a chef. She just puts out lovely food. And her mother, Rosie, is a chef and a restaurateur. So I was very inspired by them and all the people we come in contact with in the industry where we're having a wonderful meal. And it's like, oh, this is the best, thing I've ever had. And a lot of times it's just simple, clean, pure food that's not overdone.
Mm-hmm. That is the best of Mother Nature. And I love the part about The Joy of Cooking. That is my go-to cookbook. Even today with the computer and everything you can find online.
It's the kitchen Bible. I mean, it still is incredibly relevant in timeless style. Great, great product like The Joy of Cooking doesn't change too much either.
Yeah. I remember in college when I first started cooking on my own, I literally read that cover to cover. It was so much fun.
Yeah, just great basics. All right, favorite restaurants in the world. I'm going to say name up to 3. Steve?
Okay, well, so right in Paso Robles, we have a wonderful French restaurant called Bistro Laurent. It's very true and authentic. In fact, we have a French viticulture consultant who comes to visit us several times a year, and he actually gets these tiny little the Roman raviolis, that tiny little ones that he says, man, I can't even get these as good in Paris as they are here. Let's see, beyond that, well, there are, you know, just a host of wonderful restaurants in Carmel. Casanova is one of them. Very, very romantic. Great place to take a date for you listeners.
And great wine selection.
Yes. I think they have both of our wines
in
there.
I was going to ask.
Yeah.
All right, KR.
Wow. Well, that's
I know it's a tough question.
That is a loaded gun,
but just off the
top of my head, very inspired by Michael Chiarello at Bottega Restaurant. Prior to that, he had Trevina Restaurant, and is just an incredibly creative guy. I know I'm going to miss other restaurateurs that I have a huge admiration for. Bistro Don Giovanni down on the north side of Napa. Giovanni Scala has done an incredible job for many, many years, and his late wife, Donna. And then currently, there's a restaurant on the north side of St. Lena called Brasswood that about half of the staff from Trevina Restaurant ended up at, and they are just knocking it out of the park. So there's, you know, 15 others I'd love to mention, but you said three, so that's my
all right.
go-to three right now.
No, I know that was a loaded question, but I just was curious. Most unforgettable glass of wine, KR.
Most unforgettable
glass of wine.
Boy.
I know that's a loaded one too.
Well, I try to appreciate and respect all the wines, and I talk about that in context of you know, what is the price point? You know, is it a $2 bottle of wine? You know, the $2 chuck, or is it a $500 bottle of wine? And also where a wine's at in its life cycle. You know, the wine industry is competitive, but it's competitive friendly. So when Steve was talking about everything his father has developed and how he shares that with the industry, that really brought to mind for me this competitive friendly concept. You know, he could be presenting his wine to somebody, and I'm right behind him presenting to the wine buyer next, and it's done in a complimentary fashion. Mm-hmm. Oh, heavens. I don't really have one other than if, you know, the wine is clearly defective or is corked. Gosh, I'm coming up with a big zero on that one for you. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Steve, do you have one?
Yeah. You know, I would actually throw it out to one of my fellow vintners in Paso. There's a gentleman named Stefan Aseo. He has a winery called L'Aventure, which in French means the adventure. Stefan was a celebrated winemaker in Bordeaux, and his lifelong goal was to be able to blend Syrah with Cabernet. Well, in Bordeaux, that can almost get you thrown in jail because you just can't mix varieties from one region to another. And in Paso Robles, we do both Bordeaux and Rhones quite well. So he has a wine called the L'Aventure Estate Cuvée, which is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon and Syrah. And I don't now recall the first vintage I had of that. It was, you know, probably at least 10 years ago or so. But tasting beautiful Cabernet and scrumptious Syrah blended together, really for the first time to that degree, made a huge impression on me.
Well, thank you for that. Now, what do you drink at the end of a busy day? I'm going to start with KR.
Wow. Well, there's always favorite wines. Usually it's whatever's close at hand. But I got introduced about 4 years ago to a device that allows me to access wine without opening up the bottle. So
you jumped to my next question.
It totally changes the way I drink wine, because I can taste 5, 8, 12 wines without... I can enjoy what I want, when I want, without drinking too much. So I can have a half an ounce of this or an ounce of that. So I drink, obviously a lot of our wine, but I only learn by drinking other people's wines as well. So I'm all over the board. I'm drinking wines primarily from the United States because it's so relevant to what we do. So, you know, I drink wines from Washington and Oregon and all over California, and I try to hunt and peck around. I get lost a little bit when I go to a restaurant in the wine list to find wines that maybe I haven't had in a while or I'm not familiar with. I'm drinking a beautiful Merlot off of Spring Mountain right now from our good friends at Barnett Vineyard, Hal and Fiona Barnett, and it just does everything I want a Merlot to do at about $65 a bottle, which in the world of growing Merlots and Cabernets in the Napa Valley is fairly reasonably priced, you know, and I love the Schaefer wines and the Duckhorn wines, and enjoying the J. Lohr wines last night at a tasting that we did. I'm really all over the board. I can't deny a beautiful wine. If it's well crafted and well made, I have to sing its praises.
Fair enough. Steve.
So depends upon when that day ends and what was going on. You know, if it was a warm day out in the vineyards, you're looking for something kind of cool and refreshing. A Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay really fills the bill nicely there. And I think both KR and we make good examples of those two varieties. You know, if it's a little bit later in the evening and you've had that nice dinner and now it's just time to totally unwind, you know, a good Cabernet is hard to beat.
All right. No, it's great. The reason I asked that question, and you mentioned Travinier, is one time I was in class at the CIA, I went over to Travinier to get a glass of wine. Most of the winemakers that came in, they were ordering beer.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, there is that old saying, it takes a lot of good beer to make wine.
So I was curious about that. Finally, to end this, I want you to just give the listeners some advice about wine drinking. There is some, I would say, snobbery or hesitancy of a lot of drinkers because they're intimidated. Mm-hmm. So, Steve, give our listeners some good advice.
Yeah. Okay. So the first thing is just relax. You know, it's not rocket science. It is kind of rocket science when you're making the wine, but as far as drinking the wine, no. Throw the rules out the window and just go with what you want. If you want to drink, you know, Syrah with your salmon, do it. You know, likewise, if Chardonnay is your favorite wine and you want to have that with a ribeye, do it. It's okay. It's all about what you want to do. And don't worry about trying to impress your friends with, you know, gee, I got to get this really expensive wine. I think KR and I really appreciate that there's great wine made at all different price points. Just go out there and try different things. I think as brands that have worked hard to promote our areas, if you find a brand that you like, maybe try more things from that brand, because you know that there's a lot of investment that the family has put into growing that brand, and they're not going to put something out that they don't feel reflects well on the family. But it's a big wide world, you know, try wines from other countries, other appellations, but just enjoy.
That's great advice, KR.
I agree. You know, I'm always trying to demystify the wine business. And as Steve said, let's not make it more complicated. Let's make it less complicated. Let's break it down to its simplest form. And I like to say to people when I go out and do wine dinners, you know what food smells and tastes good to you at this point in time. And I don't think wine is that much different. If you smell it and you taste it and you like it, then that is a good wine. And it doesn't have to be expensive to be enjoyable and repeated. You know, there's some beautiful $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 bottles of wine out there. And it depends on the occasion. Are you just having some spaghetti or a piece of pizza and you want a little glass of red or white wine? Don't get too complicated. And I experiment. Try different things. Try different price ranges. And have fun with it. Don't make it too complicated. Try wines at different temperatures. Take a bottle of wine and pour a couple of ounces in a glass and leave it on the countertop with a coffee saucer over it or something to cover it. And then put that same wine in the same type of glass in the refrigerator. Come back a half an hour later. Try the wine out of the fridge. Try the wine on the counter. One might be too warm. One might be too cold. Pour them both together. Voila, you might have the perfect temperature. But be aware of where you're enjoying wines, how you're enjoying wines. You know, the best thing is with your friends, with some simple food or complex food, and hopefully it creates memories and it enhances the experience. But please don't make it more complicated than it needs to be and have fun with it.
Well, you two have certainly created experiences and memory. I look forward to your time here in Billings. And thanks again for helping raise scholarships for MSUB. And we really appreciate your being here.
Oh, it's great to be here, and love to support Montana State University Billings. And I have to say, everyone we've met here has just been so hospitable. It's very, very great to be here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for allowing us to be yammer on about our wines and be cork dorks and have fun with it. But it's a great pleasure for us to be able to share this with the folks up here in Billings and Montana. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stella.
A toast of cheer to you. May your days always be filled with good spirits and joy. For more information about this show, go to ypradio.org. Theme music for Flavors Under the Big Sky is by Parker Brown. I'm Stella Fong.